along with planting seeds in the ground, is so very important. Even though we did not have a farm in Yazoo City, Mississippi, where I grew up, my dad took us to farms in Georgia, Alabama, Arkansas, and we got to pick greens, peaches, sugarcane, tomatoes, you know, beans. We had those kinds of experiences. And I really think that because of it, my baby brother became Secretary of Agriculture in the Clinton administration, where he would affect policy for food. So let us continue to plant these seeds. You know, not just seeds in the ground, but we have to really plant these seeds in people's minds, and we'll watch them sprout up all over the place. You know, we'll continue to watch them sprout up all over the place. So with this, we're going to give us, the people on the panel are going to give us seeds. They're going to give us food for our minds so that we can share with that. I'm just so very excited to have them, our expert panel, with us. Their bios are in your program. And first we're going to start with Anthony Flavento. I said that. I really
didn't
say your name.
You did that.
And Anthony is founder and director of the Appalachian Sustainable Development Organization. But he's also an entrepreneur as a part-time organic farmer. And his organization is doing green flooring in the Appalachian region. So we're going to have Anthony share with us.
Thanks. Everybody here okay? I'm going to start with a couple quick quotes, one a little longer than the other, from Wendell Berry, one of his books. Wendell's one of my great heroes, I imagine he is for a few of you all. And let me say going in that I know you've already signed up for the afternoon workshops, but what I'm going to give here is kind of the big picture, which is both encouraging and depressing. And in the afternoon, I will be jumping into the practicality of what we do to try to build a more entrepreneurial and self-reliant local food system. Industrial standards in agriculture virtually institutionalize and enforce the indifference of the general population to the welfare of the land and the people of the land. Under industrialism, the farmers, and especially the smaller farmers, are overworked and underpaid, and this exactly corresponds to the condition of the land under industrialism. Much is taken, little is given back. The fertility that is given back most often comes from non-renewable sources. The organic waste that should be returned to the fields as fertilizer most often enter streams and rivers as pollutants, as do the excess chemical fertilizers. The work of the industrial economy, we may say, is to transform assets into liabilities. Wendell doesn't mince words. And more to the point, to be interested in food but not in food production is clearly absurd. Okay, so ideally I would just stop at that point, but I'm actually, I got about 7 minutes more, so bear with me. So I'm going to give Alan the little signals here. So that's my organization, Appalachian Sustainable Development. Won't say much about it except to say we're a community-based nonprofit working, if you know where Knoxville, Tennessee is, we're a little bit northeast of Knoxville, a little bit southwest of Roanoke, Virginia, about a 12-county area in the Appalachians. And we often use this, another Wendell quote, to kind of guide our work. And here Wendell says, before we do any development, I consider my organization first and foremost to be an economic development organization. And he's talking here about economic development, housing, retail development. We should ask ourselves these three questions. What's already here? Just imagine if the settlers to this country had asked that question. What does nature allow us to do here, which is to say, what are the limits of this place? And what does nature help us to do here? What are the assets that we uniquely have? Because every community, every region, every bioregion has particular assets and particular constraints. So in our area, real quickly, it's a little different from you all, a lot in common, a little different. We're more mountainous. And so first and foremost, we've got mountains. You trying to bring the lights down, Alan? Yeah, that would help a lot because you won't be able to see them well. That's better, thank you. So we've got mountains. Go ahead. We've got a lot of this pasture land. It suffered quite a bit in the drought last year, probably will again this year, but again, historically, some of the richest, most productive grasslands. And then we've got little bits of flat land. You all have a lot more flat land around here, and historically, that flat land has been in tobacco. And then we have fellows like this, Martin Miles, fourth or fifth generation local farmer, tobacco farmer. This is the core of the farmers with whom we work, folks like Martin. We've also got the reality of our assets being what we've come to say being overused and undervalued, as when our timber is extracted at high rates, whether through clear cutting or high grading, and then leaves the area with virtually no economic value added beside the price of the log. I love this graph. This comes from a fellow named Stuart Smith, who's a retired USDA economist. I met him at a Southern SOG meeting a few years back. If you kind of study that, it's in a way, it sort of, to me, in one graphic depicts the predicament for agriculture in particular and natural resource-based economies in general. It's basically a century worth of data there from the beginning of the 1900s to the end. The bottom section of the graph kind of looks beige. Let me just say that the entire thing is what we pay as Americans for our food. It's the composite of our food dollars. And the bottom there is the input costs. And you can see they've gone through various spikes, but basically they've increased about fivefold during that time. The middle is the farm gate price. That's what's actually coming to farmers. And then I'm sure you can guess what the top is that's grown so much. It's the marketing, the distribution, the transportation, the cooling, the packaging, the labeling. And so that says a number of things in that graph. One is that, as other people have noted, the vast majority of our food dollars are paid not for the food itself and certainly not to the farmers, but to the other attributes that we've come to expect, the convenience, the packaging, the labeling, the branding, et cetera, and certainly the delivery. The other very interesting thing, this is not adjusted for inflation. These are actual dollars, real dollars. It's interesting to note that at the beginning of the century, farmers got about $40 billion, and nearly 100 years later, farmers got about $40 billion. And of course, there's many, many fewer farmers divvying that up, but gives you a pretty good sense of why so many people have left farming there. In a nutshell, our work is about increasing that red area, getting the farmers more, probably, I would say, decreasing some of the top, but also capturing more of that close. I mean, people still want food convenient. They want it delivered in ways they can count on it. So maybe we can make some of those systems a little closer to home. I won't read this, but although there's still some folks who dispute this, I think it's generally fairly widely recognized that we're probably dealing with fundamental shifts in the climate and that human activities have a lot to do with it. And much of that, it's a lot of different reasons for that, but much of it comes from the fact that we move things around a lot. Tenfold increase in shipping between 1950 and 2000. Another interesting statistic that isn't up here that corresponds with that, Stacy Mitchell wrote a book called Big Box Swindle, and in that book she says that in 1960 we had about 4 square feet of retail space per person in this country, 4. In 2000 we had 38. Are we 9 times better off by virtue of having all that shopping? I don't know. Same way with shipping. Okay. And of course, many of you are familiar with the statistics that come out of the Leopold Center about the carbon sequestration, or rather the carbon emission component of our food system, the greater amount of fossil fuel energy to produce calories. And also the hidden consequences of this type of a food production system. I don't have the time to go into this, but this gentleman, Lucas Benitez, is an amazing man who's with the Immokalee Coalition of Farm Workers. But basically, the fact that so much of our food that arrives on our plates cheap, it arrives there cheap not only because of externalized environmental costs, but what happens with workers. Go ahead. There's an alternative that's emerging. This is what I'll be focusing on. It's farmers markets. Go ahead. Farmers markets that have grown from about 1,500 back in the early 90s to over 4,400 now. And we work quite a bit beyond farmers markets with actual retailers, and I will talk about that again in more detail. This is one of our local retailers, Food City, that has 90 stores. Real quickly, we work on forest-related issues, same sort of idea of adding value to your resources. So we saw the logs that come out of our forests in environmental fashion. We kiln dry them in kilns like this. Go ahead. And then we make them into hardwood flooring, as you alluded to earlier. And then I'll just close with this slide here. Some of you are familiar with James Kunstler. He's written a number of books. The last one was The Long Emergency, basically about peak oil issues. And I love this quote because he says, this is what's happening in the coming decades, that life will become increasingly and intensely local and smaller in scale, and that the only intelligent course of action is to prepare for it. I think in a lot of ways that's what many of you are trying to do here today, is prepare for what will be a very different world in 15, 20 years. Thank you.
What I'm going to do is, after speaker, we're going to allow you to ask a question. We're going to take 5 minutes for questions and answers from each speaker after each presentation. And I am going to come down to you with a cordless mic. So when you see my hips coming, you just count.
Just very briefly, essentially it's the idea of adding value to our resources. We have some of the best quality hardwood in the world in the central Appalachian areas of Kentucky and Virginia and Tennessee. And historically it's been cut at high rates and sent out for processing. So we built basically a small wood processing center. We have a sawmill, two dry kilns, and we're about to build our own millworks company. We've been contracting that out. But basically we take a very rigorous set of environmental standards under a professional forester. We manage private forest land. We process it through and we sell finished product under a green brand that we call Sustainable Woods. We sell directly to contractors and architects and others and individuals.
Okay, next question, want to raise your hand and I'll come to you.
I realize you may have already touched on some, but I was just wondering if you could shed some light on what might be the biggest barrier to sustainable systems in the United States.
What was the question?
What's the biggest barrier to sustainable food systems in the United States? There's a lot of things, but I'm a pragmatist at heart. I don't get to sort of talk about the big picture stuff quite as often. I think it's a lot of things. It's our focus on cheap food. It's our focus on convenience. It's many cultural issues. But I think at a fundamental level, the reality is most people want an alternative to be relatively easy. And the truth has been that up until very, very recently, getting something else, let's say local organic as an example of that, has just been tough. It's been difficult. Most communities, I mean, if you didn't live close to San Francisco or New York, you couldn't get it in Appalachia, that's for sure. And so a lot of, I think, at one level, one of the biggest obstacles is simply the lack of infrastructure in communities, whether it's flooring made from the trees that are right over the ridge, or whether it's food coming from the local community produced in a good way. So I think while there's many policy barriers, there's many cultural barriers, one of the big things is that most of our communities simply are not able at this point to produce food on a significant scale to get to ordinary folks at a relatively affordable, not just as cheap, but relatively affordable way. We need community infrastructure to do this, and that's what we do on a small scale.
Anybody on this side? Okay, right here.
Comment and question. Just a comment, first of all, I have to say this because I'm from Ames, Iowa. With the slide.
It's Iowa State.
That's Iowa State.
I know. Yeah. I know. Yeah. Sorry, I forgot to change that.
The question, I wonder if you just talk a little bit about the particular difficulties of transitioning former tobacco farmers into other forms of agriculture.
Yeah, it's been a challenge, and we're only recently, we've been at this about 7 years now, we're only recently having some success. The snowball's rolling down the hill, and it's beginning to build some size to it. Two things. One is that, first of all, and I was saying a little bit about this with some folks over dinner last night, the organic food or sustainable food movement's preoccupation with kind of cool specialty stuff has been part of the problem. I mean, the reality is that I crudely say that we started with an organic growers co-op that was basically a few Amish families and a couple of back-to-the-landers, and I say that the shift we made back in 2000 was from the ponytail crowd to the Ollie North crowd, and that's pretty descriptive of what it was. And what that means, and for those of you young, you can look Ollie up in the history books. But But the truth of it is that some of it's what they were being asked to grow. I mean, I could not have gone to these first few early adopters among these tobacco farmers and got them to grow, you know, Thai basil or radicchio. It just wasn't going to happen. So part of it was the choice of crop, of things that wasn't that different for them. Similarly, in our community, which is, you know, not all low income, but the Appalachian community are not full of foodies, we had to be able to produce things that ordinary people would want. So part of it was finding something other than that exotic niche orientation, which has sort of held sustainable organic agriculture in a certain box for a long time.
Kathy, our last question.
Do you have any youth involved in your program?
We do, although not as much as I'd like, and that's I was asking for some help from some of the folks here who are more involved, because that's a new emphasis for us, to be perfectly honest. We haven't done much. We do stuff with high schools. We have a learning landscapes program that's we build gardens and nature trails and whatnot, working gardens on school property, but that's been new to us, and we need more. One nice thing, though, is that when you're into sustainable farming, it does attract younger people, so the average age of the farmers in our groups is more like 40 instead of 58. But yes, we need more young people. It's kind of a weakness of our work so far.
Okay, next up we have Preston Marin, and this is Dr. Preston Marin. And Dr. Marin is the Associate Physician in Chief at Kaiser Permanente in Oakland. And he has done a remarkable thing by organizing the farmer's market for the benefit of the staff, the farmers, the visitors, and all the communities surrounding, and also working with networks of Kaiser. Now, I met him last night, so you have to go to his blog, really, and look for how to make pizza crust and all sorts of good things out of good food.
Thank you very much. It's my first time in Asheville. A couple of impressions. You know, I don't know that I've ever been to a community where I heard a young gardener talk and say, you know, we try and give away everything we grow first, and then we sell what's left over. Any place I've been around the country, it usually is the other way around. It says a lot about the spirit that I've felt from people here. Also, to go from an organization that started just a year ago to 100 different partners in an event like this today also tells me a lot and gives me a lot of hope for the future for this community in this area. It's a wonderful process, and I've had the opportunity to meet some great leaders of food security partners, and in particular I want to single out Cassie Johnson. Not only did she put this together for all of you, but she also just did a great job in organizing and taking care of me to get me here at the right place and the right time and to make arrangements. She's done a great job, and I just want to give her a special thanks. So as Joyce mentioned, I'm a physician. I've been a primary care women's health care physician with the Kaiser Permanente program for over 36 years now. Kaiser Permanente is the largest not-for-profit prepaid medical care program in the country. It's located in 8 different states in the District of Columbia. It started at the Oakland Medical Center about 65 years ago, where I've been for my whole career. Kaiser Permanente is an organization, because of its prepaid nature, the way medicine is practiced, the focus is on preventive health, not just on sick care health. And focusing on prevention, focusing on the total health of not only the members of Kaiser Permanente, but the staff and the surrounding communities, is good for everybody. And when you focus on total health, obviously, we're going to focus on food as one of those components. But when you think of the basics about health care for any population of people, do people exercise? Are they smoking or not? Is there alcohol or drug abuse? Safe sex? And when it's all said and done, what people eat every day probably has more to do with their health than almost anything else that can come up. I've certainly seen that as a physician. And for many, many years, We've tried all kinds of education programs to try to help people eat better. Next slide, please. And nothing really ever seemed to make a difference. So about 5 years ago, I thought, well, what would happen if we brought something to our hospital that really models good health, that was good for everybody? It worked well for the staff people who were there. It worked well. Could it work for patients who came? Could it work for visitors to the hospital? Could it work for the surrounding community? Could it also be good for the farmers? I found a Farmers Market Association leader who was willing to give it a try. And on May 16, 2003, we had seven vendors out in front of our hospital. It was an all-organic market. The strawberry vendor did $2,000 worth of business. And at a normal farmer's market, she usually did $800 worth of business. So that market became a sought-after market for local farmers. Next slide, please. We have all different kinds of shoppers, and here you can see a little child is getting a taste of a fresh peach. This peach was grown by Marlene Gonzalez of the Lone Oak Ranch. She's been at our market every Friday now for 5 years. Next slide. And in the background, you can kind of see all the people coming to our market right outside of our medical center. Next slide, please. Well, just taking one baby step, starting a market at a hospital, putting good food in front of people that they found hard to pass up. People then begin to shop at a market that maybe never shopped at a farmer's market before. They're coming in for health care, they're coming in for an appointment, they're coming in for an x-ray, but when they walk by a fresh peach or walk by a bundle of fresh asparagus or walk by a big basket full of arugula, people would stop and go, hey, what's that? What do I do with it? And those of us out there would talk about a simple Meyer lemon vinaigrette. It takes you about a minute to prepare, and you've got yourself a side dish for a great dinner. So from the one market, we now have 30 markets, a Kaiser Permanente facilities in six states and in D.C. Next slide, please. To keep the focus on fresh food and to just get the conversation going, I had a basic theory that if I can cook something, anybody can cook it. I'm just your basic agent gynecologist. I'm not a trained chef, but I do like to cook. My wife, my son, and I, we hang out in the kitchen. When we have a good day, we shop at a market and we cook together. So I like that. So what I would do is take whatever was fresh at the market, write up a recipe, send it out. First, it started going to just 3,000 people at my hospital. And then over the last 6 months, it turned into a blog. And now we get about 15,000 readers a month. And there are 400 or 500 recipes on this site that are searchable. Next slide, please. As you can see, I get feedback from people about the farmers markets. And when I send out the recipes, next slide, please. So then there's the logical extension. If you start farmers markets outside the hospital, what about the food that people are going to eat after they've had their hip replaced? Well, you know, like many hospitals, our food came in from many, many miles away. Often from 100 tons of it came in from other countries out of the 250 tons of fruits and veggies we used at our 19 hospitals. And we said, well, could we do this a little bit differently? Next slide, please. So as you can see, kind of the different states, 150 tons of our food came from California, but a lot of it was coming in from elsewhere. So we said, could we make a difference? Could we reduce the food miles? Could we support our local growers? And indeed, we did. Last year, we just started this program in 2006. In the last year, we had 75 different small and mid-sized sustainable ag local farmers whose food got into our 19 hospitals, 6,000 meals a day, and the cherry tomatoes on our salad. Next slide, please. It's our kind of a vision statement, which mirrors, I think, the vision of your organization, too. And next slide. And the cherry tomatoes, Mr. Chao Vang, who's a Hmong farmer who leases 9 acres, we made the connection between his farm and our hospital. And he said, thanks to Kaiser Permanente, he had a guaranteed market, he got a fair price, and he said, thanks to that kind of partnership, he's able to still be farming this year for his family. We hope to expand that kind of reach by matching local supply with local demand. And as Anthony was saying, what are the biggest barriers to a very good question raised here? In my mind, it's distribution system. Because there just wasn't a way before for Mr. Vang's tomatoes to get into our hospital. We took some existing distribution systems, also created a new one that tried to make the link between the small farmers and the big institutions. And so that's the basic message. Nothing we've done can't be done any place. It's all very, very generic. And I know that out of this meeting will come many linkages between those that grow good food on good land and those of you that want good food to eat. Next slide.
Thank
you. And if you're interested in looking up lentil soup with chard and turkey meatballs or a real simple pizza crust, and you can put anything on it you want to. Lucius might have a different idea what he would want to put on it than me, Mr. Carroll, but three different kinds of mushrooms and some herbs and some cheese can make yourself a real good pizza. Thank you very much.
Okay, I want to make sure I got this right, because the idea of what you're saying you did just sounds amazing. So a hospital that in the past paid, probably went through some other kind of middle person who did this, bought the food for you. Now you might have somebody who's doing the purchasing yourself, and so you're spending a little more money on that, but you're paying less for the food because you're buying right from the farmer.
Well, let me, we have 19 hospitals, 6,000 meals a day. 90% of the food still comes in from Sysco, because it's got to be a certain portion for this and that because of all the hospital type regulations. 10% of the food are fruits and vegetables. That's 250 tons of food. A lot of that would come from elsewhere, from large 100,000 acre growers. Okay, and it would come in through a central commissary. What we did is we partnered with a local nonprofit, Community Alliance for Family Farmers, that basically said, we will focus on the new and beginning future farmer for America and try to bring them into the food chain. We will get their food to your central commissary. Let's partner together and figure it out. And we started with 22 farmers. Now we're up to 75.
And it didn't really increase your cost?
Well, there was a slight increase in cost, but mind you, it's also less expensive to buy food in season, even at a fair price, than it is. We were buying red seedless grapes, shipping them in from halfway around the world, totally out of seasons because nobody thought about it. Well, for the last 3 years, we thought about it. We're offering things that are now seasonal much more regularly. And once again, this is only a small part of the whole system. We don't have an all-organic menu, but when we move into beef, rice, grains, milk, chicken, cage-free eggs, et cetera, yes. But one step at a time.
Okay, one more question.
She kind of just said my question a little bit, but I was going to ask, I know most insurance companies and things like this are really concerned about the economic bottom line, so could you talk about the specifics of how this is economically feasible?
Well, it works this way. Once again, we're a prepaid medical care program, so it's better for patients and for the program for people to stay healthy rather than for them to get sick. And food's important. And that's a good message for us in Kaiser Permanente's marketing campaign. If you were ever in a region where Kaiser Permanente existed, you would see a marketing campaign called the Thrive Campaign, which has been one of the most successful ad campaigns we've ever had nationally. And the Thrive campaign started because of the farmers market. The ad agency came to my hospital, talked to the employees to say what it's like to work at Kaiser. They said, hey, we have a farmers market. We are about broccoli and blueberries. So the marketing value alone far outweighs any cost for sustainably grown food and a little added cost in the food system. And that's well recognized by leadership. So it's a matter of having people see that it's a benefit for everybody, it's a benefit for the program, and we will spend more money on food because we believe it's good for everybody.
Okay, thank you so very much.